The reason for that, the indictment was based on the very rich record of U.S. and British intelligence. By now, a lot of that's been made public, including a ton of other documentation from NATO and State Department and other Western sources. And it's what it reveals is very clear. Up until a couple of months before the bombing, about January, the British, who were the super hawks in the alliance, attributed most of the crimes there to the rebels, to the guerrillas attacking Kosovo from across the border. And in the months that followed, nothing changed, at least according to the voluminous record that's provided by the West. For this reason, this entire documentary record, which is extremely rich, is totally ignored in the literature on the topic. Take a look and see. But because then, after the bombing, or after the withdrawal of the monitors under by the U.S. over Serbian objections, and then the bombing immediately, then the crimes really start. So that's what the indictment is. Of course, there's a small corollary to that. It means that the responsibility for those crimes is actually shared, since they're a direct consequence of the bombing. It doesn't exonerate the crimes, but tells you a little about the responsibility. But none of this is mentionable either. This is off the record for the same reasons. What about NATO war crimes? They certainly took place during the bombing, but they can't be investigated either. The International Tribunal did briefly make some gestures about investigating them, but they were quickly called off. The reasons were explained rather neatly by a U.S. senator who was asked about it on a visit to Canada. He said, he was asked what would happen if the International Tribunal investigated NATO crimes in the bombing of Serbia, and he pointed out that if that ever happened, the United Nations buildings in New York would be taken apart brick by brick and thrown into the Atlantic Ocean, which sort of captures the point pretty accurately. That again captures the essence of international law in the real world. Well, it's easy enough to continue, and I won't go on with that. But these are background realities that we just can't ignore in considering human rights and international law, at least if we're trying to be serious about the topic. For the same reasons, the doctrines and the practices of the United States are of paramount importance for the entire world. Economically speaking, the world is kind of tripolar, as it's called, with three major power centers, roughly comparable in Asia, Europe, and North America. But in terms of the means of violence, it's radically unipolar. It's all concentrated in one place. And that means what happens there is of enormous significance for everyone. And most emphatically, it's of enormous significance for us for two obvious reasons. For one thing, we happen to be here. So therefore, we're responsible for what happens. And for another, happens to be a country that's remarkably free by comparative standards. So therefore, what we do or what we don't do has a very great impact. And it follows that the moral responsibility is comparably great, again, if we're trying to be serious. If we want to join the mainstream, we pick a different perspective, the opposite one, again, a historical universal. Well, assuming elementary moral principles, let's take a look at the official U.S. attitudes towards international law and human rights, and then a little bit at corresponding practice. With regard to international law, there's no ambiguity at all. The attitude is very clear. Perhaps the clearest example, which happens to be highly pertinent right now for a number of reasons, is a Security Council resolution of 1986. The resolution called on all states to observe international law. That's it. It was vetoed by the United States, which therefore stands alone in declaring that states, meaning one state, doesn't have to observe international law. That was then reiterated at the General Assembly for successive years. The votes were again almost unanimous. The United States and one or two client states opposed. In these resolutions, no state was mentioned, but everybody knew who was meant. It was intended, it was aimed at the United States, and the reason was because of the judgment of the International Court of Justice, the World Court, shortly before, which had condemned the United States for the unlawful use of force, meaning international terrorism, in its war against Nicaragua. The United States, incidentally, stands alone in the world in having been condemned by the World Court for international terrorism and by the Security Council in the follow-up resolution that it vetoed, so it's entirely natural that the United States should be lauded now for leading the war against terrorism, without any reference to any of this, of course. The reason for rejecting the World Court decision wasn't just a decision. They ordered the U.S. to desist, to pay reparations. The reaction was to immediately escalate the war. The reason for the rejection of World Court jurisdiction was explained by the State Department legal officer, Abraham Sofer. He reviewed the history of the relation between the United States and the international institutions. He pointed out, he did it accurately, he said that right after the Second World War, we could count on other countries to go along with anything we did. They'd vote with us at the United Nations and so on, for pretty obvious reasons, which he didn't explain, and you don't have to. But as decolonization set in and the United Nations began to reflect a wider range of opinion, and as Europe and Japan were reconstructed from the war, the United Nations stopped being a reliable instrument of support for U.S. actions. And as a result, he said, we can no longer count on other nations of the world to go along with us when we do something, and therefore we must reserve to ourselves the right to determine when some action is within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States. In this case, the act that was within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States was a terrorist war against Nicaragua. These things ought to be taught in elementary school, in my opinion. They're very great significance for anyone who wants to understand anything about ourselves, which is presumably an important topic. They certainly ought to be headlines right now. It's all very pertinent. For one thing, because the reason I already mentioned, the one state that has declared its immunity to international law and has been condemned for international terrorism is now leading the war on terrorism, without any comment. For another, because the actions that Nicaragua took in this case do serve as a precedent as to how to respond to acts of international terrorism, and recall that that was far worse even than the events of September 11th. There are methods to respond by law-abiding states. Nicaragua pursued them, obviously couldn't get anywhere. It was up against a power that doesn't observe any of these rules. But if the United States wanted to pursue those paths, nothing would block it. It was a decision not to pursue them. Well, that's not the only case, neither the first nor the last. Just to take another, there's no one in the United States who's more lauded more effusively for his defense of international law, his lonely battle for international law, than Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Article after article, biography just came out last year, which emphasizes it. When he resigned from the Senate a year ago, there was an accolade in the New York Times Magazine by a left liberal writer, Jacob Weisberg, who again praised him for standing up for international law and fighting this lonely, courageous battle at the United Nations, where he was U.S. representative for a while, and he emphasized particularly his tremendous courage in criticizing Idi Amin and defending Israel. That takes a lot of courage in New York. The biography does the same thing. Always pointedly omitted in all of these accolades and praises is the most important action that Moynihan took while he was U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and which he's quite proud of. He describes it in his memoirs. The action that's actually the most important act of his life in terms of its human consequences by far. The act had to do with the Indonesian invasion of East Timor in December 1975. The invasion was immediately condemned by the Security Council in a resolution unanimously passed calling on Indonesia to terminate the war crime, which is what it is, and the crimes against humanity which immediately followed. And to withdraw from East Timor. But nothing ever happened, and Moynihan explains why in his memoirs. I'll read it in his words. He said, "The United States wished things to turn out as they did and worked to bring this about. The Department of State desired that the United Nations prove utterly ineffective in whatever measures it undertook. This task was given to me, and I carried it forward with no inconsiderable success."